Welcome, everyone. This is Kevin Gianni from RenegadeHealth.com, and today we have a very special interview. We have Dr. Catherine Shanahan. She's a board-certified family physician. She trained in biochemistry and genetics at Cornell University before attending Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. She practiced in Hawaii, this is family medicine, for 10 years while she studied ethnobotany and her healthiest patients' culinary habits. So that's what we're really going to dig into today. And now she has a family practice in New Hampshire, so that's up near where we're originally from. And she is the author of Deep Nutrition, which is Why Your Genes Need Traditional Food. And we're going to be talking about deep nutrition today. So, Dr. Kate, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get started with giving everyone a brief introduction, maybe a little bit longer than what I just did, about how you got interested as a physician in nutrition, because I think that's kind of really important.
Right. Yes, actually, a lot of doctors do go into the whole world of medicine because we want to get to the bottom of health and sickness, but we settle for the idea that there's not a lot of answers and start practicing just based on the way we're trained to practice, more focusing on prescriptions, not really getting to the underlying cause of stuff. And the reason I got into this was I had always wanted that myself, so much so that before medical school, I needed to go to find out more about genes and how genes work. So I went to Cornell University biochemistry program and learned at that time that the whole genetic modification, this was in the 1980s, was geared towards manipulating DNA in ways that I did not think they were ever going to be really successful with. That I had to leave, and I could not pursue that kind of line of work. It just seemed like it was being used more, I guess I would have to say, characterize it broadly as for evil instead of good, because what they were doing was manipulating, they're trying to patent life itself, and that just didn't appeal to me at all. So I was a little disappointed, but I had learned a lot of really interesting things. So then I went to medical school and hoping to be able to get to the root of things like shin splints, because as an athlete, I was plagued by shin splints myself, and I noticed that a lot of people who wanted to be healthy and active couldn't because their bodies wouldn't let them, and I didn't understand what was the difference there. I had hoped to be able to get to an understanding of that by going to Cornell molecular biology and biochemistry programs. But since that didn't happen, I figured, oh, well, maybe medical school will give me some insights. And that didn't happen either. So I graduated from my residency program in 1997 and was practicing in Hawaii in 2002. And I had, by that time, just kind of settled for the idea that medicine was going to be prescriptions. You know, I did like the ability to help people understand what was going on in their bodies, but I didn't really have any great answers for the deeper questions, like why do I have irritable bowel now, or why are my knees bothering me and I'm only 30, that kind of stuff. In 2002, I developed a serious health problem myself that left me unable to walk for 2 years, and it was a problem with my knee, and I went through surgery. I did the whole usual spiel of trying to figure out what was wrong. There were no answers for me either, and so stuck on the couch, I had nothing to do but listen to my husband, who had been telling me for years I ate too much sugar. So starting from that, I got interested in nutrition and ultimately discovered the works of Weston Price, became confused by how they conflicted with what I learned in medical school, specifically about the value of saturated fat and animal products, and also some just fascinating insights that he had into the ability of diet to change physical appearance, which to me meant changing genes. And so that opened the door to a whole series of insights that that enabled me to put together the book Deep Nutrition over the following 5 years, in which I came to understand so much of what I had really gone to medical school in hopes of understanding, being able to understand these differences in physiologic ability, you know, why some people are tougher than others, why older folks were telling me, you know, kids these days, and why I got a sense that kids these days, you know what I mean by that? There just seems to be so much more trouble with the health of younger folks than the older folks remembered occurring for themselves or even for their own children. So that kind of, I got into it just because of an accident of my own physiology being bad and wanting to find the answers for my own health. And once I did get to that point, I changed everything about the way I ate, and thank goodness I had a husband, Luke, who's my co-writer, who is also a very talented chef, so he could make it all taste good. And so I went from not being able to walk at all, and today I just went for a 4-mile jog, so I'm very happy about that.
That's fantastic. I want to talk about genes, and I want to talk about how they affect, one, our appearance, and two, our overall health, because you've done a lot of research about this, and I think it'd be really valuable to outline some of the things that you've learned about this so everyone can understand.
Right. So those are two very interesting questions. So the way I have come to understand genes is almost as much metaphysics as science. The fascinating thing for me is that I've come to take this perspective that, you know, me, my patients, you, we're just a little blip in the long, long story of DNA, which began, they say cellular life began somewhere around 2.5 billion years ago, and life itself may have begun as early ago as 4 billion years. And so we're still working with the technology that was developed in the very early Earth, and by technology, I mean the genetic material. And it's been a continual growth process of that genetic material going from what it was, whatever it was in the beginning, even before there were cells, to single cell life. And we still have that technology, the capability that very, very early genetic material had in terms of being able to burn glucose for fuel, for instance, or being able to have enzymes that need vitamin B. So there's this long story of our own bodies that began 4 billion years ago. And the DNA that we have in our bodies is engaging in this ongoing, super long conversation between the earth itself and the nutrients in the environment that we draw our sustenance from. And so that when, you know, our own bodies they didn't look anything like this, maybe say 5 million years ago. And 5 million years from now, who knows what we'll look like. But the point being that what we do during our lifetimes in terms of the nourishment that we get, it's going to change that conversation potentially forever. So when we eat a certain way, that will affect the way our children's genes function and ultimately how they grow and what they look like. The good news is that our DNA is very adaptable. It's very accustomed to change because that's what's been going on over the past 4 billion years. There wasn't even hardly any oxygen until something like, I forget now, something maybe like 2 billion years ago or something. They had this thing called the oxygen crisis, and almost everything died. And then mitochondria developed that could use oxygen for energy, and it was such a coup that almost every single multicellular organism now has mitochondria, which originally were separate entities that cells actually just engulfed and kept around because they were so useful. So that all is kind of extremely exciting to me as a biologist, because It just means that there is something really profoundly cool about what goes on our planet that doesn't seem to happen anywhere else in the universe, and that, you know, we are understanding it now in such a cool way. But that's probably getting away from what you really wanted. How does it change the way we look? Well, what we've started to realize, my husband and I, who's my co-writers, Luke, he's a writer and really has a poetic mind. And the way he puts it is that the health and beauty of our children is limited by the health and beauty of the planet. Because of that long ongoing conversation that our DNA has had where we draw from the earth itself, our DNA is accustomed to information from the planet. And as we've changed the planet over the past, 100 years in an accelerated way, so much so that from outer space it looks completely different probably than it did even just 100 years ago. Or when you're flying over the Midwest, now you see all these scars of monoculture cropping and all kinds of, cities and asphalt and cement and unnatural shapes. That means that the beauty of the planet is limited, and the health of the planet is limited. Those areas of America and of the Earth that we have retooled for our own uses are no longer as diverse or healthy as they were when nature was in charge. And the very same thing can happen to our bodies, because now that we have less wild to draw from, to eat from, we're forced by economics, many of us, or just by sheer saturation, market saturation of lower quality foods in our grocery stores, to draw from that less attractive area of the planet, so that our for most people who follow the food pyramid or the standard American diet, most of their calories actually come from monoculture cropping, specifically corn and soy. And you would imagine that just, the metaphysics of it, where that those areas of the planet where corn and soy monoculture crops are grown are less diverse, less physically beautiful. If we really are a reflection of the health and beauty of the planet, then you might imagine that people who eat from those places will have, that will be reflected in their bodies. And indeed it is, because what we're seeing now is that, we're seeing so many more children born with different health problems. And the most striking, I think, now is autism, which is something around 1 in 100 male children are born with autism. And to understand why that happens, a lot of people have had the sense that there is something in the environment, and vaccines have been blamed, and telephone wires and magnetism and all kinds of things have been blamed. But what they do find is that the genetic material of children with autism has all kinds of little errors in it that they call single nucleotide polymorphisms, meaning that the replication process of DNA from mother to son or mother to child has gotten mangled. And it's most likely, in my scientifically, oriented opinion, because the raw materials to reproduce DNA itself are no longer available to those people who follow the standard American diet. And so that their children not only have these mutations within their genetic material, their brain does not develop normally. And that is reflected in the physiology of the brain. There's some really fascinating science now showing that when you do MRI, there's a certain type of an MRI scan that evaluates not just the structural like brain parts, like the cerebellum and the amygdala and those little parts that you that we've been talking about for a long time in neuroscience. But there's a new technology that can understand the connectivity and the pathways between like the eyes and the back of the head. And what they have found is that children who are healthy have more symmetry in those pathways than children who have autism or other learning disorders. There's actually an asymmetry so that you can see now autism, and you can see what it looks like in the developing brain. And the same kinds of things have occurred in the physiology of the body too. As a doctor, I've noticed that a lot of children this goes along with what Dr. Weston Price noticed as well, is that there's a narrowing of the faces, there's narrowing of the nose, the jaws become narrow, the teeth are more crooked. And then I've seen as the children grow that they tend to have thinner bodies as well, like their hips are, women now in their 20s have narrower hips. And if you look back at some of the movies from the 1950s and you see like these va-va vrooms with these giant hips, and boys too, I see a lot of boys growing very tall, but their shoulders are kind of narrow, their chests are, they have what's called pectus excavatum, where instead of having those nice strong pectoral, not man boobs, those are those overweight guys, but you know, the muscular image of the guy, the tough guy on the beach, and the chest has what they call a large AP diameter, so from front to back is thick compared to a woman's. I see a lot of these boys now in their 20s graduating from college, and they've got narrow chests, and they're backs are actually even starting to curve a little bit. So you get that kyphosis, which is what we see as people age, where they're getting a little bit of a hump. So it's to me, observing all this, it's very sad, and but it does reinforce the idea that our children's health and beauty is truly limited by the health and beauty of the planet, and that what we have to do to be healthy is to connect to the beauty in the planet, to connect to those areas of the planet that still offer the diversity that our DNA has evolved with over the previous 4 billion or so years, and is still expecting all that different fatty acids and all the diversity of minerals and so on and so forth that are not available in the standard American diet anymore. And it's changing the way our bodies work at a genetic level, and we can literally see it when we watch people walking down the streets.
So when we're eating our poor food and we're having negative gene expression, how do we reverse that? How do we get back to what we're supposed to be eating?
Right. So can we reverse negative gene expression, right? That's one question. Then the second is how. So there's a science called epigenetics, which I talk about in our book Deep Nutrition. And epigenetics is a branch of genetics, or actually it began as a branch of genetics. It literally means upon the gene, and it studies the relationship between the environment and DNA. And epigenetics is showing that the environment changes DNA constantly. It's not like we have to wait a generation to see change. Every minute when we're breathing air that's either clean or polluted, drinking water that's either got drugs in it or doesn't, experiencing stresses that are beyond normal or getting enough sleep, it has effect on our DNA that we can measure. It's not always going to change the letter code, but it's going to change the expression, and then the expression ultimately does change the letter code. So that's how it happens. It's all the science of epigenetics, which is now actually taking over the field of genetics, and there's more people going into epigenetics than just straight genetics. And so it's a really exciting time to be in genetics. And so to answer the question, what do we do? Well, how do we get to, to make sure that our genes are doing better, to get away from the standard American diet, is the short answer is we want to connect to the beauty and complexity of the environment. That's the first part. There's actually two parts to the answer. So we want to eat from a healthy earth. The second part is we want to do that in a way that our genes expect, right? So we could go to a pristine meadow and start eating the grass, but that's not going to do us a heck of a lot of good because our genes are not adapted for that. So we could go to, so what we have to do is, at this time in history, we have to understand what it is that the human body really needs from the earth. We never had to do this until fairly recently when our cultures became somewhat homogenized and confused, you know, about 1,000 years ago when the Native Americans lived where I'm living right now in New Hampshire. There was a strong cultural imperative directing them pretty specifically exactly what to do. And it was just based on common sense, human abilities, using tools in the way that humans happen to evolve to do, and drawing from the resources of the earth. So that included foraging for all kinds of things when they were in season, and that includes all kinds of plants and animals, cooking some of them, fermenting some of them, the same kinds of things. Wherever you look around the globe, people tended to use the same tools. We used fire, we used the process of fermentation, we used knives, and some foraging techniques, and in some places farming, but that tend to lead to using or to getting a similar set of nutrients within that culture generation after generation after generation. And so that it was, you know, by virtue of your birth location, you knew exactly what you were supposed to eat because that's what your grandparents did and that's what their grandparents did. And it was successful because you were still human. But now, because our cultures are so homogenized, we've lost touch with our culinary roots, which I think are a hugely important part of who we are as humans. And we have people who have a vested interest in making us unhealthy, unfortunately, telling us or influencing what we eat. So it's extremely confusing. And that's why I wanted to write a book about what the research was that I did and my conclusions as to what we need to do so that we can be as healthy as possible. And so in the center of the book, I have a really big chapter called The Four Pillars of World Cuisine. And in the center of Deep Nutrition, that is, I have two books. And I talk about the four pillars as being the four kinds of techniques that people around the globe seem to universally do, and that we ought to do all of those too. And most of us, unfortunately, only do one or two. If we are following the standard American diet, we're lucky if we do even two. We really there's a lot to learn from traditional cooking practices, and that's kind of what we go into in the book Deep Nutrition.